Well, good morning. Good morning. It's great to be here with you. Glad to have you guys here. As Jake mentioned, we're starting this new series this morning in the book of Ezekiel. It's an in-depth look at one of the most difficult books in the Bible to interpret. It's a book full of mystery, imagery, prophecy, judgments, promise. It's going to be a challenge, but a fun challenge to look through it together. Before we do that, though, I thought we'd start by taking a few moments to consider something from our own contemporary culture that combines those same things, judgment and mystery and prophecy and promise. Of course, you probably realize I'm talking about the HBO hit show Silicon Valley, right? It's pretty interesting to watch a show that's about the place you live in. It's like someone reading your diary and telling your jokes and surfacing the experiences you have. And what I want us to do this morning is take a brief look just at a short video clip from this show. It's the first 12 seconds of the show. It's the intro sequence. And it's really quick, and it's really frenetic, and it's really chaotic, so you won't get it all, but that's okay. As someone said, it's probably about the only 12 seconds I could show in church. But I want you to just watch this clip and take a look at what you see and what you experience. All right, let's show it. All right, you get it all? I've actually seen there's like an 8 or 10 minute clip where somebody goes through this and points out all of the cultural references, all of the stories of companies that rise and companies that fall, of young billionaires who make it and lose it, of successes and failures. And in that little 12 seconds, there's decades of stories of things that have happened around us in our area. Delivery drones and hot air balloons and all sorts of things. And I think one of the purposes of this show, Silicon Valley, is to take a step back and to answer the question, what is going on around here? So much is changing, so much is happening. How do you make sense of it all? How do you process all the cultural change and professional change and everything that's happening? How do you make sense of what's happening in our day and age? Well, it turns out that the book of Ezekiel is asking some of the very same questions. It takes place shortly after God's people have been forcibly relocated from their home in Jerusalem to live as exiles in Babylon. And it opens with this fast-paced, frenetic vision full of imagery that pulls themes and references from all sorts of Israel's history as a way of letting them know that their God sees what has happened to them and he's got some answers. So Ezekiel receives this vision and gives us this book of prophecy, partly to answer the question for God's people living in exile, what is going on around here? How did we find ourselves here? What happened that this is the new normal? In fact, answering these kinds of questions is the task for most of the prophets in the Old Testament. We like to think of prophets as people who predict the future. And in fact, sometimes they do that, but the main task for prophets is to make sense of the present, to open the windows of heaven, and to help us to recognize what's happening here and now in light of who God is. Even visions of the future that say what's about to happen, the purpose of those still are to make sense of what's happening now. And so as we begin this book, we're going to see Ezekiel addressing the people of God living in Babylon and helping them to answer the question, what is going on? Now, ultimately, he's going to be helping God's people to answer the big question. Not just what's happening, not just what is God doing, but who is this God that would allow or permit or cause or whatever it is, these things to happen? who is God in light of the things that we're experiencing? And so this morning we kick off this series that we've called Knowing the God of Justice and Hope. Over and over again, over 70 times in the book of Ezekiel, we will see this phrase that God explains what he's trying to do in this book is to help people know that I am the Lord. Prophecy is given that you may know that I am the Lord. Judgment is given that you may know that I am the Lord. Promises are given that you may know that I am the Lord. Over and over again, to know God. And isn't this what we need? To see what's going on around us, to understand our present, to make sense of all the crazy things happening in our world in light of who God is. We need this for ourselves, to understand politics and government and economics and corporations and career and hurricanes and parenting and romance and school and everything that happens around us, all of the little parts of our lives and the big things that are happening internationally. We need to grasp those things. We need to make sense of them in light of who God is. Now, Ezekiel helps the people in his time to understand what God is doing in their day and age. But God's doing something different then than he's doing now. God isn't doing the same thing for the exiles in Babylon that he's doing for us in the 21st century in Palo Alto. The circumstances are different, but God is the same. And so how do we take that? How do we take the revelation of the character of God and use it to help us to understand our day and age? This is our hope throughout this series, to see what God is doing, to try somehow to make sense of it all. Now, we need this for ourselves. We need this in our own lives to process the events and the things we've seen. But we also, as people of the living God, as people who know God, we recognize that we have some responsibility, we have some task to bring that perspective to light for the world. We've talked about this a little bit before, and this is part of what has led us to study the book of Ezekiel, this awareness that the church has some sense of a prophetic vocation in the world. Part of our calling as the people of God is to help bring the character of God to bear on current circumstances for the people around us. Our calling is not to align ourselves with this party or that party, to pick sides and fight battles and win battles. Our calling is somehow to be a third voice, to step outside of it all, and to bring to light God's perspective. Now, this is the idea that Jeff Louie is going to be teaching a class on starting in a couple of weeks called The Prophetic Voice of the Church. There's information in the bulletin about that. That's going to really address those issues in particular. On Sunday mornings, we'll be doing this deep dive into the book of Ezekiel, trying to apply Ezekiel's words to our lives. This morning, we'll begin by looking at this opening vision of Ezekiel. It's basically the same as the Silicon Valley intro, with a little bit of some differences. We're going to see God arriving to his people in Babylon. We're going to see this vision unfold in five different sections, and we're going to see how each of those highlights something about God. And we're going to see a glimpse of this idea that God is a God of judgment, but also one of promise. Now, this show, Silicon Valley, I'm not sure they've actually made sense of much of what's going on around here. I'm not sure there are any answers for how we found ourselves here, for what's really going on for us culturally. But I'm convinced as we look at this book of Ezekiel that we're going to see something powerful about God. That's my prayer as I've been studying it. That's my hope as we share it with you and as we work through it together, that we together would encounter this God and learn something of him. So let's begin by the first couple verses in Ezekiel. This is Ezekiel 1, verses 1 to 3. In the 30th year, in the fourth month, on the fifth day of the month, as I was among the exiles by the Kebar Canal, This is Ezekiel speaking. This is a location in Babylon. The heavens were open, and I saw visions of God. On the fifth day of the month, it was the fifth year of the exile of King Jehoiachin, the word of the Lord came to Ezekiel the priest, the son of Buzi, in the land of the Chaldeans by the Kebar Canal, and the hand of the Lord was upon him there. Now, these verses place this particular scene around 593 BC. It's a very significant time, a very significant period in the life of the nation of Israel. About 130 years earlier, the northern tribes of Israel had been conquered by the Assyrians. They had already been wiped out. And about 12 years earlier, the southern tribes of Israel began to be conquered by the Babylonians. And as it would happen, that conquest would occur over the course of several waves, spanning about 20 years. This vision places us right in the middle of that 20-year period where Babylon was progressively conquering Judah, headquartered in Jerusalem. That period would end with the destruction of Jerusalem, the destruction of the temple, but now we find ourselves in the middle of it. And it's almost like this snapshot in time. It's like watching a train wreck in slow motion. The building is falling, and this vision catches us right there. We know what's going to happen. We know what has happened, and we're watching it fall to the ground. The exiles in Babylon who received this vision, they had already marched about 1,000 miles from Jerusalem to Babylon. Probably took them about 4 months. They'd been deported by a foreign army, and they're asking the question, what is going on? We're tired. We're confused. We don't get it. What's happening? Now, this is when God tends to show up in the Old Testament. In those moments where we just can't make sense of all that's going on, it's when we need him the most. Maybe that's true for some of you right now. Maybe there's personal things in your life going on where you don't understand what's happening and you need God to give you some perspective. Maybe that's true for us as a nation. Maybe that's true for us as a world. Maybe as a church. Maybe we're at a point where we need God to say, this is who I am. We need some vision of him to help us understand. As the vision progresses, we're going to see how God reveals himself and what he does for these exiles in Babylon. Listen to verse 4. As I looked, behold, a stormy wind came out of the north, and a great cloud with brightness around it and fire flashing forth continually, and in the midst of the fire, as it were, gleaming metal. Now, we've got some Bible scholars in the room. Where does this remind you of? Where have you heard this before? Cloud and fire. Does anybody remember this? The Exodus, right, exactly. Over 800 years earlier, God had led his people out of slavery in Egypt. Exodus 13:21 says this, and the Lord went before them by day in a pillar of cloud to lead them along the way, and by night in a pillar of fire to give them light. The story of the Exodus was one of the foundational stories for God's people. This is who they were. They were the people that God had rescued out of Egypt. God led them out of slavery with a pillar of cloud and a pillar of fire. But now, God had led them into slavery. God had led them from Jerusalem into Babylon, to the heart of the enemy. And they were slaves there. And so they receive this vision of the fire and the cloud coming to them, and they realize something critical. The God of the exile is the same as the God of the Exodus. They were, in a sense, experiencing a reverse Exodus. They were going back into the land of their enemy. But God comes to them reminding them that he's the same God. And this is really important for us. We like it when God rescues us, don't we? Those are the stories we like to tell. We love the Exodus. We love Moses leading the people out of Egypt, leading them to freedom. But what do we do with the exile? What do we do with God leading his people into slavery? What do we do with those times in our lives where God doesn't seem real, when he doesn't seem present, when things don't make sense, when we haven't been rescued? What do we do then? Where is God at those times? Do we need to know that God is the same in the exile as he is in the Exodus? You know, I grew up without a whole lot of pain in my life. I had a fairly happy childhood. And I remember sitting in church, hearing people talk about difficult things in life, wondering, will I still believe in God if things get really hard, if the bottom drops out? Now, I haven't had as much pain as some, but I've experienced hard times, and I would no longer say my life's been free of pain. I faced harder times than I ever thought I would, and I can say that I found God in the exile in ways that I wouldn't have found him in the Exodus. Maybe that's true for some of you as well. I know that's true. I know some of your stories. That sometimes in those moments, we find God in new ways, powerful ways. So the vision begins with this reminder, the fire cloud arriving. And then we get this picture of creatures. Let's read this. Verses 5 through 10. From the midst of it, that's from the midst of the fire cloud, came the likeness of four living creatures. And this was their appearance. They had a human likeness, but each had four faces, and each of them had four wings. Their legs were straight, and the soles of their feet were like the sole of a calf's foot, and they sparkled like burnished bronze. Under their wings on their four sides, they had human hands, and the four had their faces and their wings thus. Their wings touched one another. Each one of them went straight forward without turning as they went. As for the likeness of their faces, each had a human face. The four had the face of a lion on the right side. The four had the face of an ox on the left side. And the four had the face of an eagle. Now, if Ezekiel had described a vehicle with the body of a Tesla and the screen of an iPhone and the sound of a Dolby movie theater, we'd go, oh yeah, I get it. I see all the things you're combining. That would be an amazing vehicle, right? But when's the last time you saw an ox? It's been a while, right? When's the last time you saw an eagle or a lion? Most of us have only seen those things in the zoo, but for God's people, these are the things they lived around. And so he's given this picture of these four living creatures. They're roughly human. They have two legs. They have four wings, like most of us, right? Instead of one face, they have four, though. They're a combination of these four animals. The ox was known for its strength. The lion for being ferocious. The eagle for its flight. And humans for their intelligence. Most of them, anyway. I debated about showing us a picture of these creatures so we could grasp it better, but I think we're supposed to see it in our heads. I think we're supposed to imagine this kind of creature. And what we're supposed to see, I think, is the best of the best. The kind of creature that combines all the best features of all the animals into one. It's kind of like the Avengers team, right? All the superheroes combined into one team of incredible power. The power of the Hulk, the technology of Iron Man, the hammer of Thor, the good looks of Captain America, the sticky webs of Spider-Man, right? It's the team combined together. This is what we see, the ultimate war animal coming out of the fire cloud. But these creatures also remind us of creatures we've seen before. I don't know if you remember this, but the wings that are touching each other. Do you remember this? In the Holy of Holies, in the temple, above the Ark of God that signified the most intense place of God's presence were these cherubim, where their wings were outstretched, touching each other. And those heavenly creatures were the guardians of God's holiness. They were God's bodyguards. They protected his presence. Now, what's strange, though, is that we're familiar with those creatures in one place. They stay in the temple. But these are moving. These are coming to Babylon. Why would God's bodyguards be coming to Babylon? Why would God be coming to Babylon? And what's even more strange is how they are moving, the method of their movement. That comes next. Listen to verses 15 to 18. Now, as I looked at the living creatures, I saw a wheel on the earth beside the living creatures, one for each of the four of them. As for the appearance of the wheels and their construction, their appearance was like the gleaming of beryl, and the four had the same likeness, their appearance and construction being, as it were, a wheel within a wheel. When they went in any of their four directions without turning as they went. And the rims were tall and awesome, and the rims of all four were full of eyes all around. So the four living creatures stood at the four corners of something, and under each creature was a wheel, more specifically a wheel within a wheel, probably one wheel with another wheel perpendicular to it inside of it. And the significant thing about these wheels is that they went in any of their four directions without turning as they went. Now, with the addition of the wheels, we're starting to realize that what we're looking at is a chariot. What we're looking at is some kind of a war chariot. Now, chariots had become popular. They'd been invented about 1,300 years earlier. And when chariots were invented, they revolutionized warfare. But at this time in history, chariots were actually on the decline because chariots were fast, but they weren't very maneuverable. In fact, the cavalry was on the rise. People riding horses, soldiers on horseback, because they could turn faster. Here's the problem with chariots. Chariots suffered the same problem that every military vehicle that's ever been invented has suffered. Has the same vulnerability, the flank, the side. See, a vehicle goes in one direction, right? And when you're traveling in one direction, what makes you vulnerable? Attack from the side. Why? Because you can't turn fast enough to face it or evade it. Now, imagine a military vehicle that can change directions immediately without turning. So you're going in this direction, an attack comes at you from the side, and immediately, without turning, you can face that attack. That'd be pretty cool, right? You'd buy a car like that, wouldn't you? This is the kind of technology that Ezekiel is witnessing. It's a marvel we haven't even invented today. Even today, we're subject to the basic laws of physics and momentum that when you're going in one direction, there's something called momentum where you can't just change. Except for those spinner luggages, right? That's basically what this is. Did anybody have those? You know when they first started putting wheels on luggage and you could pull it, and I was like, this is great, but you can only pull it in one direction. But now, if you've had those spinner luggages, you can pull your luggage anywhere. It's amazing. That's what this is, all right? It's the heavenly war chariot version of spinner luggage. You got that picture? This is an unbeatable war machine. That's what Ezekiel is seeing. Two more parts of the vision to go. Most of the elements so far have been pulling in references from the nation of Israel's past, the temple, the tabernacle, the ark, the Exodus. But now we go even further back. Listen to verse 22. Over the heads of the living creatures, there was the likeness of an expanse shining like awe-inspiring crystal spread out above their heads. Now we're going way back to creation. The expanse was that word used in Genesis talking about the heavens above. It's used in the Psalms to say that the sky above proclaim God's handiwork. Now this vision isn't just Israel's vision, it's cosmic, it's universal. And then the sound gets turned on. Up until this point, we've been seeing this vision on mute. But in the next verse, we hear something. Listen to verse 24. And when they went, I heard the sound of their wings, like the sound of many waters, like the sound of the Almighty, a sound of tumult, like the sound of an army. When they stood still, they let their wings down. And there came a voice from above the expanse over their heads. When they stood still, they let down their wings. The vision comes alive with sound. Tumultuous, deafening, army sound. And out of that sound, a voice. The last part of the vision, we get who that voice belongs to. Verses 26 to 28. And above the expanse, over their heads, there was the likeness of a throne, in appearance like sapphire. And seated above the likeness of a throne was a likeness with a human appearance. And upward from what had the appearance of his waist, I saw, as it were, gleaming metal, like the appearance of fire enclosed all around. And downward from what had the appearance of his waist, I saw, as it were, the appearance of fire. And there was brightness around him, like the appearance of the bow that is in the cloud on the day of rain, so was the appearance of the brightness all around. Such was the appearance of the likeness of the glory of the Lord. And when I saw it, I fell on my face, and I heard the voice of one speaking. Now the picture is complete. The voice belongs to an individual in the likeness of a human. And now we understand what this vision is. This vision is the king riding on his throne, sitting atop the expanse of the heavens, on a chariot borne by any direction wheels, led by the ultimate war animals, with the fire cloud of God going before it. This is a terrifying vision of the King of Israel, the King of the universe, arriving in Babylon to meet the exiles. The glory of the Lord has left the land of Israel, and the glory of the Lord is meeting his people in Babylon. You know, Ezekiel is one of only two prophets in the Old Testament to receive the word of the Lord outside of the land. The fact that God would leave his land, would vacate his temple, would come to his people outside of the promised land, this was a huge deal. What was God doing? Why was God, the king, the ultimate warrior, why was he coming? What did this mean? God arriving on his war chariot. When I first started studying this passage, I wanted this to mean that God was coming to comfort his people in Babylon. I had a whole sermon written. You guys would have loved it. It was soft and warm, and God was going to come and hug his people, and it was so nice. But as I kept studying the passage, I realized God's not coming with comfort in mind. He's coming as a warrior. He's coming to do battle. So I thought, well, maybe he's coming to fight the Babylonians, right? Maybe he's coming to free them. Maybe this is a new Exodus. Maybe he's going to fight God's enemies again. But God already had that chance. He let the Babylonians win. He let his people be deported. So why is God coming to his people in Babylon? This warrior king has not come to save his people. He has come to judge them. We have hints of this judgment in this passage already, the outstretched bow, the power, an unbelievable strength of God in this vision. And as the book of Ezekiel progresses, we will see more and more that this is the tone of the book, at least in the first half, that God has come to judge his own people. God has come to judge. This vision from Ezekiel actually shows up later in the scriptures in Revelation 4 and 5. We see the four creatures again. We see the wings, although this time they have six instead of four. We see the throne. We see the glory of the Lord. We hear the sounds. And in Revelation, the purpose is even more clear. This is the king come to judge his servants. This morning as I was driving to church, I was leaving my neighborhood, and I passed this woman standing on the side of the street, and we made brief eye contact, and I'm not sure what I did wrong, but I did something wrong in her eyes. Pure judgment aimed at me. Maybe I was driving too fast, I don't know. Is that what this is? Has God come to his people to glare at them, to show his disapproval, to get them in line? This kind of judgment turns a lot of people away from religion. Why would we want to come and be judged? Get enough of that in my neighborhood, right? Why would we do this? What do we do with a God who judges us? How do we feel about that? A God who would even judge his own people? Well, this isn't people judging each other. This isn't our petty differences. This isn't our opinions of each other. This isn't me judging you or us judging them. This is the God of the universe judging evil. And when we're honest, we want a God of justice. We want a God who judges evil. Everybody, everywhere, in every culture appeals to some kind of justice, some kind of judgment of evil. We want a God who judges terrorism and white supremacy and the sexual exploitation of children and greed and anger and narcissism and violence. What good is a God who lets all that go by? What good is a God who doesn't judge? We want a God, we need a God who judges evil. And when we're honest, I believe we want a God, and I know that we need a God who judges evil even when he finds it in us. What good is a God that I can fool with my weak attempts at appearing righteous? What good is a God that I can trick into believing that I'm okay, the problem is with all of you? What good is that kind of a God? I don't want to believe in a God that gives me a pass just because I'm on his team. I want to believe in a God that holds me accountable when I deserve judgment. This is part of what it means to have a prophetic voice. God's people aren't exempt from judgment. We are not the voices of judgment. We do not call forth judgment on all of them. We believe on a God who judges evil no matter where he finds it, within the church, without the church, in culture, outside of culture. God judges impartially. You aren't a better person because you're in church. You're not exempt from God's anger because you're part of his team. God judges evil, even in our own hearts. So what good is it to be here then? Why would you come to church? Why would you believe in a God like this if that's all you get? Well, because that's not all you get. Because when we see this vision again in Revelation, there's a change to it. There's something different about it. The Son of Man is there again, but he's not Ezekiel, he's a lamb who was slain. Revelation 5, 9 reads this. And they sang a new song, saying, "Worthy are you to take the scroll and to open its seals, for you were slain, and by your blood you ransomed people for God from every tribe and language, and people, and nation." Our God is a God who judges. Make no mistake about it. But he is also a God who turns that judgment upon himself, who puts himself in the place of the consequence for all of that evil that he judges. God has come to judge, but God will come to restore. God will come with words of promise. Our King, our God, our Judge has been slain, and by his blood, he has ransomed his people. He has set his people free. He has judged them. He will judge them. But then he takes the consequences of that judgment upon himself. Now, this is a theme we're going to be working through week by week as we look through Ezekiel. There's a lot of judgment in Ezekiel. The whole first half of the book takes place during this interim period before the final destruction of Jerusalem, and there is a lot of prophecy of God's judgment on his people. But then things turn in the second half, after the destruction of Jerusalem, God starts to speak of restoration, of promise, of redemption. And so we have this combination, this mystery, this paradox. This is what makes the God of Israel the God whom we want to know and worship, because he is the God of justice and of hope. When my children were little, I was always struck by how they reacted when I would punish them or discipline them. They were hurt, but they would want me to comfort them. They're teenagers now, of course, so that no longer works, but we can work on that, right, kids? Even though I was the one who disciplined, I was the one who comforted. Maybe that's part of what Jesus meant when he said, have faith like little children. Maybe that's part of what we can find in this book of Ezekiel. Maybe my hopes that this would be a sermon of comfort, maybe we can find some anyway. Maybe judgment and comfort go together in God. And maybe when we realize that, we can come to God in new ways. I'm convinced this is what we need. The world is confusing. We can't make sense of all the events that are going on. We can't understand it. It's above our ability to understand. It's just too complex. But we can know the God who is the same today as he's always been. He offers us himself so that we can know him. So my prayer throughout this book of Ezekiel is that we can find comfort in knowing this kind of a God, that we can reconcile the God of judgment and promise, that we can open ourselves up to him, allow him to come to us as he's come to his people in Babylon, and help us to make sense of our world. We find ourselves in the middle of a crazy time in history. Self-driving cars, delivery drones, artificial intelligence. We want to ask what's going on and we want answers, but maybe there's not answers, but maybe there's a person who will come to us and allow us to know him. I know it's scary, but we can embrace this God, the God of justice and hope. Our King has come to judge. Let's welcome him. Amen.